Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the church.
This is Why I Believe on the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Rick Starr, and we're talking today with Glenn Rawson and Dennis Lyman, who produced a TV series on the Joseph Smith Papers and recently also released a series on the history of the saints, covering from the martyrdom to the gathering of the saints in Salt Lake City. Dennis and Glenn, welcome on our program today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's introduce you to our listeners. First of all, if you could tell us a little bit about yourselves, Dennis and Glenn.
Sure. I'm Dennis Lyman. I've worked at KJAZ Television for 20 years for Larry Miller and Gail. Did some church history videos for Larry for the station at the time. We worked on a handcart video up at the Devil's Gate, Martin's Cove Visitor Center that's up there. And then Larry had us do a 7 one-hour part series called Utah Remembers. And then, boy, the history just took from there. Produced 4 temple DVDs, the Pioneer Temples in Utah, 90-minute documentaries on that. And then was introduced to the Joseph Smith Papers with Larry Miller, called and asked me to shoot the video for all of that. And then Glenn and I met, and here we are, History of the Saints and Joseph Smith Papers, 150 episodes later.
My goodness, that's a lot of episodes.
That's a lot of history.
Wow. Were you raised in the church?
I was, The history bug didn't hit me till about 15 years ago, though.
Oh.
I love it. Can't get enough. Everyone has a story.
Yeah. Oh, and the saints have wonderful stories
they've
covered.
Yes, they do.
Introduce us to yourself, Glenn.
Well, I'm a native of Idaho. I have a rich pioneer heritage, and but I knew nothing about it. I was raised out of the church, so my grandfather left the church years ago and eventually found his way back, but my family, I was raised out of the church. When I went to college, I joined the church. I used to ask my dad, you know, about my history and where I came from, and he would say, you come from a long line of horse thieves, boy.
That was it, huh?
Yeah, and that's all I knew. And it's interesting, just this week, I found, by searching through some of the websites, I found my family and their immigrant voyage from Liverpool, from England, coming to America. I found my family name in there.
Wow, incredible.
So anyway, I joined the church when I was 18, went on a mission, and then most of my life I've been a ranch hand, a truck driver. And then about 15 years ago, we started producing stories on the radio, and some of Larry Miller's people had heard those and asked me. I was on a trucking run up through central Idaho near the wilderness area. They called me and asked me if I would come and be involved with this series, the Joseph Smith Papers. I've always loved the prophet Joseph, and so I came down and got involved. Dennis and I met, and like they say, the rest is history.
Wow.
I still live in Idaho. We work in Salt Lake and produce a series from there.
Wow, that's great. Was the original seed for the Joseph Smith Papers series, was that a Larry Miller project at the time?
I think it was between Larry and the church history department.
Oh, okay.
And I remember one day I was sitting in a doctor's office, and my phone rang, and it was Larry, and we got talking about this project. It was the first I had heard about it directly anyway. Mm-hmm. And we got talking about it and what he wanted me to do and what he wanted out of the project. And an hour and a half later, I found myself out of my car and I'd missed my appointment because I got up and walked out. But we talked for about an hour and a half. And what he told me about the project was that a lot of these scholars are getting on in years. So what he wanted to do, the whole purpose of this was, besides the books, was to get the interviews on record so they could transcribe them. So if anything happened to these historians or scholars, that we would have their word transcribed, at least from video to the transcription. So that was really the original plan for the whole thing. It wasn't a series. Mm-hmm. It was just to get the words and, you know, transcribed.
But as you mentioned, it turned into a 98 series.
It did turn into 98 series, and holy cow, it was a lot of fun. We flew back to Boston in August of 2006, the first time, with Ron Barney, the church historian. That was he the lead editor on?
He was one of the main editors.
On yeah. Mm-hmm. Went back there with another videographer and myself, and we stopped at every site that Joseph had anything to do with in his family, and shot video of the sites so we could at least have some video to put on a special or two when we were finished with this project. Mm-hmm. And then that was a 10-day tour, and then in October of 2006, we took a tour back with all of the historians and the scholars at that time and their spouses. And at every site, historic site that we stopped at, they had a presentation prepared to give at that site, one of the historians did. Mm-hmm. And we recorded all of those. So we would have all of the transcriptions from that. But by the time we got – before we even started any of that, we had shot approximately 40 to 50 hours worth of interviews here at the conference center before we even knew what we were doing with it television-wise. So we had had 40 or 50 hours worth of interviews there, and then this 10-day tour with the historians and scholars at all of these sites. We had so much video. I said to Larry, we can't just do a special. We have too much here. And then the interviews continued on even from that point on. So that was kind of the birth of the documentary series. So that was kind of fun.
And then that's where I entered the pictures. After they had done all of this, they brought me in to write and mm-hmm. assimilate all this material, and with the help of the scholars at the Church History Department, to write the series.
So you wrote the series, and Dennis, you
shot the video.
You're the mm-hmm. videographer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, what a great team
it's
turned out to be.
It's fun. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, I know there will be way too much to cover in this short hour that we have. But just speaking about the Joseph Smith papers, what are some of the things that really touched you as you learned so much about the Prophet Joseph Smith?
I think the thing that touched me the most while I was learning about Joseph was it's one thing to read about his life. It's another thing to be there and be on site and feel the spirit of place. It's something else for me personally anyway to know that his family believed in him, not just someone that had written it down and that I had read about, but to know that his mother and his father and his siblings all believed in him, and the fact that no matter what happened, they were there. And people that have families, I mean, that's special, I think. I think it's different than reading it from a book. Mm-hmm. We were lucky. We were able to see his journals up in the archives, the first Books of Mormon in 1830 that were printed. We've seen documents that there's probably a lot of people that we'll never see before. Of course, there's Glenn. He sits and reads them all while I try to light them and shoot them. I don't get to read them. I just see what they look like. I don't know what's in them. But we've seen some wonderful things. And going through the Kirtland Temple, you know, there was a lot of wonderful sights.
That's neat.
Many, many things.
Glenn, were there any particular stories that really touched you about Joseph Smith?
Well, generally speaking, I knew all along that Joseph was a prophet. And I had studied his life and his teachings and the stories about him. But when we got deep into this project, you could say that because the scholars were so well-versed, they brought us in and they showed us. We got close to Joseph with their help. They showed us his history. We studied his life. For me personally, it's like I knew all along that he was a prophet. But I had no idea what a great man he was. I saw the opposition. I saw the accomplishments. I saw Joseph's weaknesses, what some would call his mistakes. I saw the human side of him, mm-hmm. and that made him all that much greater. I remember particularly we were out filming one day, and Dennis mentioned the spirit of place. We were at Liberty Jail, and we were there filming everything we could for the jail for use in the show. And I had nothing to do except be in his way.
Which he does a lot.
Which I'm good at. So I asked for permission. And the visitor center was closed, and the missionaries were right there with us. I said, could I just go down in that cell and just sit on the floor? With some apprehension, the missionary said, sure, just don't touch anything. So we went in, or I went in rather, stepped down inside that cell, and understanding that that was the original floor. Everything else was a mock-up, but that floor was original. I sat down on that original floor right next to the Prophet Joseph. And I was immediately wrapped up in a feeling of what he called the spirit of place. To borrow the phrase of Paul, I was a prisoner with the Prophet Joseph for a time. I felt some of what he felt, identified with where he had been and that he had been on that same floor. All the way through our experience, at least for me personally, I was allowed to get close to the Prophet Joseph, and the history proved the testimony. The most compelling thing that I'm trying to say is that studying the life of the Prophet Joseph, seeing his history, proved what the Holy Spirit had already borne witness years ago.
Mm-hmm. Take us inside that a little bit. I mean, as members of the church, we hear a lot about the Prophet Joseph Smith. But we don't always get the day-to-day play-by-play of Joseph Smith. And you saw a lot of that. You mentioned Dennis Sr.'s journals and that kind of thing. Well, what's the day-to-day with Joseph Smith like? What are the character traits you see there in his life story?
Well, for example, we were in a shoot early on, and we were with Ron Esplin, who leads the project on the Joseph Smith papers. Mm-hmm. And all these cameras and lights, and I'm completely overwhelmed. It's his world, but it's not mine. I really was the guy with the face for radio. So this television thing is kind of new. And I was just standing there holding this, quote, old dusty book. No idea what I was holding. And Brother Esplin said something like this, do you know what that is? No, not really. That's Joseph Smith's first journal. I was overwhelmed. I opened it up and began to read. And as I read, and this is the response to your question, as I read, I saw a man like myself who had the same feelings about life, about his family, mm-hmm. the same frustrations about day-to-day experiences, the same burning testimony that comes out in the journal pages, things I had seen myself write just like that. And I don't know if I should say this or not, but then the journal just sort of dwindles out after a few days. He had the same struggles keeping a journal that I do. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of what we learned all the way through. We saw the man, but then completely unlike myself, I saw the prophetic mantle on him. I saw the power of him speaking in Canada. I saw, as I read through the history, I saw him magnified in ways that are just beyond human. This man was a prophet of God. You could see the divine. So I guess to summarize, the beauty is we saw the man, we saw the husband, the father, the friend, but then we saw the prophetic mantle in ways that human understanding just can't explain.
Incredible. You're listening to Why I Believe, the production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our guests today are Glenn Rawson and Dennis Lyman, who are the executive producers of a series on the history of the saints as they traveled west from Nauvoo. And we've been talking about an earlier series that they produced on the Joseph Smith papers, where they followed Joseph Smith basically from Palmyra to Nauvoo. That's the life of Joseph Smith right there from the time of the first vision. And his childhood. Then you go from there basically after the martyrdom, starting with the history of the saints, this uh-huh. next series, mm-hmm. and go west with the saints. So you've covered the whole Mormon experience, early Mormon.
And it's
experience.
Wonderful. It is wonderful. From the martyrdom, approximately where the Joseph Smith papers ended, like you're saying, we started with the martyrdom mm-hmm. and came west with Brigham and the Vanguard Company. And, you know, another one of those spirit of places is Carthage Jail. Our first episode, we drove back to Carthage, and the missionaries, after they closed the historic sites department, let us go in there and shoot some of our stand-ups for those first couple shows mm-hmm. alone. Well, there was a missionary downstairs, but that's a pretty powerful place to be when you're in there by yourself upstairs in that room in the jail. And we were up there for 4 or 5 hours, and that was a powerful experience. But we started there and just picked it up with the aftermath, what was going on in Nauvoo, preparing for the first exodus. And once they leave that first company and get across to Montrose and start crossing Iowa, it's a new world. It's different history. It's just with Brigham. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing story. And there are so many different aspects to it. I had no idea. A lot of people think hand carts are about the only thing that happened mm-hmm. coming west. That's pretty much what they know about. But when you learn about Iowa and the difficulties they had there and the way stations they had to prepare and the mud and the rain and the snow and winter quarters and Canesville, and it's an amazing history. And it's like you're a kid in a candy store when you learn these things. There are so many things. The Mormon Battalion, I mean, we've learned so much that it's hard, you can't even remember it all. Mm. And the neat thing about it is that Glenn and I will sit through everyone's full interview, not just a little piece of it that you see on camera on television. Mm-hmm. But we're lucky enough to sit there and hear the whole story. Most of them are at least an hour interview.
And that by people who've devoted their lives
yeah. to the history.
To perusing yes. these journals and knowing these stories and knowing yeah. these people. These are not lightweights. It's just like being taught by the world's best professors.
Yeah, it's they're the best that there are in the world as far as I'm concerned. And they're right here. They're at BYU and they're across the street in the church history department. And, you know, going back to Joseph a little bit, some of those documents, but Glenn and I were able to see the accounts of the first visions and Joseph's history that he starts writing by himself. And the beautiful thing about it is you can't learn the history without learning about Joseph. You can't learn about Joseph without learning about the history. Mm-hmm. So you're getting the complete picture, the Missouri era, the Illinois, the Kirtland, the New York. You have to know it all. It's just one big picture. Mm. And so from Nauvoo into the valley, that's just another chapter of it with the three exoduses. And we saw a journal entry from Thomas Bullock where he wrote about the miracle of the quail when that poor camp came out of Nauvoo, the last of the saints to come out of Nauvoo, where the quail landed on their tents and on their tables and such. But you see the handwritten account from Thomas Bullock in that journal. It's one thing to read it and learn it in church, mm-hmm. but when you see that actual document that's written exactly like you learned it, not a lot of people have had that experience that Glenn and I get to have. It's, wow. And we can bring that to you as the viewer. And that's where History of the Saints is a little bit different than the Joseph Smith papers. The Joseph Smith papers is more academic, document-driven. History of the Saints, with Glenn's experience in storytelling, is pretty much each episode is telling a story. And we've been able to go back 4 or 5 times and get the video in different seasons and these interviews. And we've just had the freedom to do what we want to do under our management. And we have an editor that is just an amazing editor. And Glenn will write it, I will shoot it, and then we'll just dump it in his lap and he'll just say, be gone. And he adds his touch and the music and the graphics. And there's three of us that put this together as far as getting it on television. But we couldn't do it without a network that we've created of stations and the church history department, the historians, the scholars. This is the place, BYU, artists. So many artists, and we have a couple girls that write the music for us. So there's a network here of people that just do it to help for the cause, mm-hmm. And it's we just could not do it without them. Incredible. You know, we're the three principals, but we are nothing without this support team. Mm-hmm. And they just do it because they want to help. So,
did you come off of the Joseph Smith series with the ideal already in place to do the
Glenn and I have spent a lot of time together. Uh-huh. We talk a lot.
So we finished. We do this.
Well, we finished the Joseph Smith papers, and as it was winding down, and we'd come to the martyrdom, it had been so well received, and the saints were so hungry for their history. We thought, let's just pick it up where we left off. Let's just go on, and so we hatched the idea of this sequel series, History of the Saints, and then other people saw the vision, jumped on, helped us, facilitated it, and we're a year and a half into the second series.
Hmm. So you've produced so far about 35 programs.
We're at about 50 now. 35 with the first season. That's
okay,
correct.
The first season.
And we're
mm-hmm.
15 shows into the second season of approximately 30. Hmm. And there's just so much to do. The more we do, the more we learn, and the more there is to do. So the history is vetted by some of the church historians, and that's mm-hmm. something that I really want people to understand with this History of the Saints, is there are three people at least that look at every script that Glenn writes to make sure that history is as true as they know it, mm-hmm. so that we're not just out there saying something that someone said or, you know, in their interview, but they go over everything we do to make sure that's correct. And we're pretty happy about that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this series. And starting at the beginning, the martyrdom is where you start in this series. And that is, of course, a huge turning point for the church with the transition of leadership from Joseph to Brigham Young. Talk about some of the things that you learned about what was going on during that time, right after the martyrdom. What happened?
We had the experience of interviewing Dean Jesse, and Dean is the dean of historians. He knows his stuff. Mm-hmm. He told us about that period of time right after the martyrdom. And he made the statement, and the record bears it out, that there has never been in Mormon history a time where there was more grieving, a more black, miasmic grief that settled upon the saints mm-hmm. than that time after the martyrdom. It was such a shock. And today it remains. We are still a grieving people over the loss of Joseph. It was a time for the saints at first of confusion in the midst of that grief. Who will lead us now? But then the beauty of that is that when Brigham Young and the 12 get back from their missions and come back to Nauvoo, and on that day in August, when Brigham stepped forward and asserted the keys that the 12 had, the confusion parted like sunshine coming through the clouds, and the saints knew who was to lead them. They did not know the exact events of the future, mm-hmm. but they knew where the keys were and who to follow. It's quite a contrast, and the human emotion, the journals of that time, are vivid in their descriptions, their grief, but then also their faith in President Young and the 12.
Mm-hmm. A couple of surprises. I didn't get to watch every program in the series because there's 35 of them in the first season, but a couple of surprises that hit me. About 10,000 saints viewed the Prophet Joseph after the martyrdom. And I thought that was very interesting. And Governor Ford, I didn't know about his close involvement with the proceedings and his concern about war. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about some of those things.
Well, again, the thing that is difficult, and we walk a fine line, is that you want to respect the living and the dead. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to malign anybody, but the record bears out, and President Hinckley even spoke of it, of Governor Ford's duplicity in all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, when Joseph went to Carthage, he was released on charges to come back. I mean, he was free to go. The research has borne out. He was free to go, and on his way out, when he was served with that writ of treason and held, Governor Ford was warned this whole thing, when the saints left Nauvoo, the record bears out they were angry and resentful at the United States government for not helping them in Missouri, and they were angry at the officials of Illinois, led by Governor Ford, because they basically held Joseph hostage. And the record bears that out. And of course, Joseph was murdered. And that resentment carried all the way across the plains. And thus, when the saints enlisted in the Mexican War as part of the Mormon Battalion, most of us today don't recognize how difficult that was for them, what a shock to their sensibilities that was, what a sacrifice, because they're being asked to aid the very cause that had taken, in their estimation, the prophet and the patriarch. Makes it all that much more astounding.
Incredible. You had mentioned, Glenn, earlier in the program that you've had a personal discovery here about your own ancestors just this week. Were there other occurrences that you know about, either one of you, about your own ancestors being involved in the Trek of the Pioneers? Or tell us the story about your own ancestors.
First of all, about Dennis. He's a great-great, etc., grandson of Amasa Lyman, who was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. And today, you know, Amasa gets a lot of bad press coverage for events later in his life. But if you go back and look at that early record, Amasa Lyman was there from the days of Nauvoo and before. Dennis, you ought to say something about that. He was very integrally involved in early church history
and was
a good man.
Yeah, he went on many missions. He donated his entire life, you know, for the church once he had been converted. And he was a special guy. He really was. It was sad what happened there toward the end of that. But not only him. My great-great-grandmother is Eliza Partridge also that was with the prophet for a time. And she came out west later. She lost a baby at Winter Quarters. She buried a five-month-old baby there. And then after she'd been there a while, she came out further west, and then she had a baby at the confluence of Laramie and the Platte River
at Fort Laramie.
Mm-hmm. And named him Platte Lyman, who ended up going down being one of the head of the company for the Hole in the Rock down in Bluff.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I have some great heritage with Amasa and Eliza and – It's just been a lot of fun. It sure makes it a lot more fun when you do have that connection with that. And Amasa went down with Charles Rich and settled San Bernardino there toward the Gold Rush and collected tithing down there to bring back for Brigham and brought back the Mississippi Saints there at Fort Laramie. He went down and helped bring them back with some of the battalion. Got into the valley 2-3 days later than Brigham did. But it's some great history. I love it. It's everyone has a story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's just and they all tell it differently, and it's everyone feels things differently. But it's boy, what a great history! What a great history.
Glenn, talk a little bit about yours, your discovery as well.
Well, it's kind of old and new because, as I said, I knew that I came from pioneer stock, but I didn't know that much about it, and I still have a lot to learn about it. And then we were interviewing Fred Woods at BYU, and he had told me about this Mormon migration website that had been done through BYU. In my ignorance, I knew nothing about it. I should have, but I didn't. So Fred told me how to find it. I found it. I went on there, typed in my ancestors' names, and discovered when they had left Liverpool, the ship that they were on, when they arrived in New York, how they rode the train to Benton, Wyoming, the captain of their leader on the ship, the captain of their ox train when they came on into the valley. And then I knew some of the history from there because my great-grandfather was a babe in arms on that journey. He was just an infant. And came, and they settled up in Idaho in the Ejin Bench country up there, were some of the first ones there. And I knew the history from there, but finding the origins of it was unique and fascinating. That was the old. And then because of Dennis and I's efforts, I've had the opportunity to take all seven of my children back on the trail on numerous occasions. Take him to Carthage and to Liberty and to Devil's Gate and Chimney Rock and share those stories. That was the neat part for me, is to be able to share those stories and teach my own babes about their history in these places and their greater history as Latter-day Saints.
Incredible. You know, I'm sure you've piqued some of our listeners' interest now, as you mentioned your discovery. Where would a listener go to find out about their history like you did?
There's a couple of places you can go. Through BYU, there's a Mormon migration website. Mm-hmm. And if your ancestors were immigrants that sailed, most of them came out of Liverpool in England. If your ancestors were immigrants that came anywhere before, well, any time in the 1860s or 70s or even earlier, that website will probably have them listed. Then again, if you come to the Church History Library, they have another migration website, Pioneer Trails website there, and they have like 3,000 journals that they've entered that, and these companies that came by wagon trains over the plains, and you'll probably find them there as well. So there's at least two places you can go. Hmm. And again, these experts at the Church History Library can put you onto both of them.
That's great. You're listening to Why I Believe, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our guests today are Glenn Rawson and Dennis Lyman. Glenn, you mentioned that you took your family along the trail. You mentioned the, how did you say that before, the sacredness of place?
Spirit of place.
The spirit of place. Along that trail, the Mormon trail that went from Nauvoo to Salt Lake, the Salt Lake Valley, were there any specific places for each of you where you really, really felt that spirit of place?
There are so many.
Talk about that. But what you felt there.
I'm a trail guy, so anytime I'm in Wyoming, I get on the trail, I feel it there. You get into those like Devil's Gate and obviously Martin's Cove and those types of places, but there are so many trails still out there in Wyoming that you can go be on, and the the landscape and the Guernsey ruts. And most of that stuff, you know, was the Oregon Trail also. It wasn't just the Mormon Trail until you get close to Fort Bridger. But you get over there by Parting of the Ways where you can see it way off and go up toward Oregon and Idaho. Mm-hmm. And then it just comes down toward Fort Bridger. And anytime I'm on that trail, the Guernsey ruts they're an amazing place if you haven't been there. That those ruts are just deep in that granite stone where they came across there. And Chimney Rock, every place along that whole trail has feeling to it. And boy, if you had ancestors that did it, then that makes it exceptionally special.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. There was a place particularly that as you go along the trail, anywhere along the trail, like Dennis says, you feel their presence. Mm-hmm. But we were at Fort Laramie, or what's left of Fort Laramie in Wyoming, and we had learned from the scholars, Bill Slaughter and Mike Landon and others, that those forts were so critical and during the frontier period because, in effect, they were the Costco of the plains. That's where you came to resupply, re-equip, recruit your oxen, etc. So Dennis and I drove up there just to film. It was a beautiful, windy day. The wind always blows in Wyoming, but it was a windy day.
There's a surprise.
Yeah. And I was standing on the porch of one of these old buildings, and I could just hear in my imagination the hullabaloo of an ox company coming in, of a wagon train moving through. I could hear the voices. It was just like it was so real. The written word of the journals began to echo in my ears as I was at Fort Laramie. And you could just see it, and you could hear what this place was 110 years ago. Amazing.
Incredible. When you said spirit of place, it really touched me because I remember having that feeling going to the Nauvoo Temple the week before its dedication and looking at the stone on the front that says when the commencement of the building of that temple began. And it doesn't say that it was in, you know, latter days. It's, mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't say that it was in the 2000s or anything like that. It said that the commencement of the building of that temple was in, I believe, 1838 or something like that. And it struck me that, you know, that building was a completion of a work that began so long ago. It wasn't just, you know, a new foundation built in the 1900s or 2000s. It was the finishing of a building that started, you know, 160, 70 years ago. An incredible feeling. And it was, like you said, it really overcame me, that spirit of place.
You know, along those same lines, this is my own personal feeling. The reason that I am here in this valley today is an accumulation of a lot of people would go back and say the exodus from Nauvoo to get here, but I take it all the way back to when Joseph was born. I mean, I believe it's an accumulation of everything that's happened from December 23rd, 1805, mm-hmm. till now is the reason that I'm here and enjoy what I'm enjoying in these beautiful mountains, you know. And so mm-hmm. Along those lines, that's my feeling too. I really think it's an accumulation that started back then. Not in 1955.
But long before that.
We're working on a series of shows right now called Life on the Plains or The Journey to Zion. And when you find out or when you study and learn just what these pioneers went through, there is no tendency to downplay it. They were incredible people. Now that I have to say it this way. They were ordinary people just like you and I. They loved, they felt, they lost, they died, they lived just like we do. But they were tough and they were hardy and they were not accustomed to camping out on the plains any more than we are. And you read journal accounts about how they figured out how to take a bath, how they figured out how to cook mm-hmm. out there. And your respect for them, your admiration for them grows. I say it again. The history supports our faith, doesn't contradict it. It supports it. It amplifies it. It gives it illustration. And it gives it more meaning.
Wonderful point. Let's talk about some of the people you discovered on that trail, some people that touched you. Go ahead.
The first one that comes to mind is Erastus Snow, who mm-hmm. is just a young man out on the plains in the Vanguard Company with Brother Brigham. And it was his job one day to be guarding the cattle. Well, he didn't do it. He did not do it. He shirked his duty for one reason or another. And consequently, the cattle wandered off and mingled with the buffalo. And the next day, Brother Brigham was furious. In rounding up the stock, he lost his telescope, his spyglass, they called it. That made him all the more angry. And right in front of the whole crowd, in Brother Brigham's inimitable style, he dressed him down. And chastised him, if you will, right before the company. Well, Erastus, who's just a young pup, makes the mistake of defending himself, and that made Brother Brigham even more angry. And he didn't insult him. He just called it the way he saw it, and he was right. And he asked for the congregation, the men assembled, to sustain him in his chastisement of Erastus Snow. The men all sustained him. Well, later on, and then Brother Brigham says towards the end, now you just be quiet and go back and get your work done. In other words, end of story, it's done, don't make the same mistake twice. Erastus writes in his journal, I've been a member of this church, dozen years, I've never been chewed out like that, and I hope that's enough to last me for the rest of my life. And what really got me with that story is Erastus bore no grudges, accepted it meekly, went on with responsibilities, and within 2 years he was called to the Quorum of the Twelve by Brigham Young. And that's just one example of some of the events. And we were at the place where this happened, near it, and it's just amazing.
Incredible. Dennis, how about you? Any stories of individuals?
Well, mine
that
is
really
more so, it was a show from this season. It was on Oliver Cowdery. Mm-hmm. And that was a special show. I think that's been my favorite show of the second season. And just to get into the archives to see Oliver's letters back to Phineas Young about being reinstated in the church and being – that Oliver was there when the church was new, and under the hands of John received a lesser priesthood, and under the hands of Peter the greater priesthood. And to see that written in those letters on that old paper, it almost looked like linen, didn't it?
Yeah,
you could see the weaving
accounts.
From Oliver's hand. And I just didn't know a lot about that one, but that one just, you know, we're in that little room over in the archives all by ourselves with these letters, and it's just, that was a powerful show. And it's so fun for us to be able to bring that to you, the viewer, that you wouldn't normally see. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have someone tell you that story. You could go back and get a shot of the Susquehanna River there at what was then Harmony. But to see that letter in his handwriting to Phineas, whom helped bring him back into the church, mm-hmm. you just it's not the same. It's not the same. It is so powerful to be there, to read these, that it's a lot of fun to be able to bring that to the viewer.
Mm. Incredible.
And there's hundreds of stories like that.
Yeah.
Reading the journals of someone like Louisa Barnes Pratt. Her husband, Addison, was sent to the South Pacific to open up missionary work there, and he was gone in 46 when the call came to go west. And Sister Pratt was indignant. "You want me to go west, but you call my husband the other side of the world? Didn't you bother to ask me if I wanted to go?" And Almond Babbitt looked at her and said, "Well, Sister Pratt, they not only expect you to outfit yourself and go, but to take somebody else along with you." She was so indignant. She wrote in her journal, she said, "Well, I'll show them what I can do." And the rest of her journal is so entertaining. You read her journal, and this plucky little woman outfits her company, gets her wagon, starts across the plains. It nearly kills her at winter quarters. She talks about shaking so bad with the ague at winter quarters that she felt like her bones were disintegrating. Her children huddled around her. I mean, one moment she's out on the plains and she's reveling in the glory of the flowers and the mountains and the birds, and she's loving life while she's tramping through mud. And the next minute she's almost dead at winter quarters. What an odyssey. The world has nothing over on us on a fascinating story, I'll tell you that.
That's true. You know, the thought occurs to me, you two have been at this now for about 6 years, if I'm doing the math correct.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And you've gone through a lot together, a lot of stories. And you mentioned that, Glenn, that you've taken your family out on the trail and that kind of thing. How is your involvement in learning and sharing the history of the saints affected your families?
My family is so devoted. I've never done anything in my life, in all of my professional career, I've never done anything where my family has been more supportive, more kind, and more sacrificing. Because again, this is private. It's not funded. It's us.
Mm-hmm.
And they have made more sacrifices for this project than anything we've ever done. And they recognize, and I'm speaking just for myself, that this is a consecrated effort in large measure. Our intent is to teach and to edify. That's why we do what we do. And Dennis says this all the time. We're not steering this ship. We've known that from the beginning. We put ourselves forward to tell a story, and we've been led and directed. Our families have done the same to help us, and it's just been a marvelous thing, a very unifying thing.
He said it perfectly. It's mostly the family behind you, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to learn the doctrine, and it's another thing to bring that history in with it. And it is so fascinating, and it is so much fun to learn and just to go out places like Mount Pisgah and Garden Grove and Locust Creek and Sugar Creek, where most people don't know where these places are, and to be able to bring that back and to teach the members of the church and so they can visually see what it is. And it's just, you can't put a dollar value on this.
Glenn, you mentioned a little bit earlier where you felt like you had been led. Can you share an example maybe of a time where you as a writer, you're trying to storyboard a program and figure out how it's going to go, and then maybe a discovery, suddenly something opened up, and it's just like it takes a whole different direction. Can you share a little story about that?
That's the story of this whole series.
About
the book
every
of,
week.
The Book of Mormon phrase, line upon line, precept upon precept, has really applied to what we've done. I'll just give you a brief example. We were interviewing Fred Woods at BYU just earlier, and right in the middle of the interview, we are talking about migration from England and ocean voyages and the saints coming over, and all of a sudden it's just an epiphany. You know what? This story isn't going to make a bit of sense until we talk about PEF. And most of your listeners will go, PEF, what in the world is that? And therein is the story. We find story after story embedded in our history that we as a people don't generally know that enriches and enlarges and it illustrates. The PEF is the Perpetual Emigrating Fund. So we're going to do an entire show on the Perpetual Emigrating Fund so that Mormon migration makes sense. Mm-hmm. Another example, and Dennis mentioned it, we were in the middle of talking about the journey coming across the plains, winter quarters and Brigham Young and the Vanguard Company. All of a sudden, we keep hearing something about this thing called the Ponca Camp. Ponca Camp, what in the world is that? So we explored, we talked to the scholars, and out of it came one whole show, and a fascinating show about the saints of the Ponca Camp in northern Nebraska. While there was winter quarters in the saints down here, mm-hmm. Ponca Camp up north.
Now you've got my interest. give us a little bit of information on the Ponca Camp.
Well, President Young had wanted the saints into the valley by 1846. So he sent men on ahead, mm-hmm. trying to get them while he brought the main body of the saints. It didn't happen. Winter came too quickly. The Mormon battalion was called, so they had to go into winter quarters. Well, Newell Knight and a bunch of others were clear out at Grand Island, Nebraska. They didn't want to go all the way back, so he said, hunker down here. They couldn't. It wasn't safe. So they went north to the confluence of the Niobrara and the Missouri River, and they literally carved a fort out of the wilderness in the middle of nowhere, and it's cold and desolate there. Mm-hmm. And they spent the winter of 46 and 47. And on Christmas Day, 1846, a fire broke out on the prairie coming right towards the settlement. And all the pioneers turned out and fought that fire to ground. There's, 100, 200 of them up there providing for themselves. Mm-hmm. They fought the fire to ground by 11 o'clock that night. But in so doing, Newell Knight contracted pneumonia. This is the same Newell Knight from Colesville that had been with Joseph since he was a boy. Hmm. And we were at the archives and we opened up Newell's journal. It's January the 1st, 1847. And he describes in there how he is so sick and how he feels like he doesn't want to live anymore, like he's being drawn to the other side of the veil. But then he says, if I have a greater work to do, or if my family needs me, I'll stay, but I don't want to. And then in big, bold letters he wrote in his journal, Thy will be done, O Lord, and not mine. 10 days later, he's dead. And you pick it up with his wife, Lydia, now with 7 children, 1,000 miles from anywhere, and she's standing at his graveside. And in an act of complete submission, with total grief at the loss of her husband, she wrote in her journal, God rules. And then the odyssey of Lydia and this whole Ponca camp coming down and eventually finding their way to the West. Lydia winds up in St. George as a temple worker in her last days, and her son, Jesse, becomes influential in Utah history as a mining and a philanthropist. But then near the turn of the century, I guess as a touching postscript, Jesse went back to Ponca, and by that all remnants of their civilization there where he was born is gone. And he tries to find his father's grave, and he can't. So he builds a 30-foot obelisk, marble obelisk, places it there in memory of those saints at Ponca Camp, mm-hmm. and it's all that remains of our history. And very few people ever go up there to see what was a whole story of our history.
Incredible. Thanks for sharing that. Well, Dennis and Glenn, we only have a few minutes left on this program. I'm interested, just as we close out our program, if you would share how your production of these series has affected you personally and your testimony.
It's affected me dearly, actually. There's so much to it that I didn't know. There's so much more to it that I don't know. And every day it strengthens your testimony. These people were special. And I have a little slogan that I say is, I want to work as hard for them as they did for me. And so that's kind of what drives me.
Hmm. Incredible. Thank you.
President Hinckley used to say that we stand on the shoulders of those who come before us. And I guess what's most affected me, besides a deep, deep affection for them, I didn't know them, but I know them better now. I love those pioneers. I love our history and our forebears. I have a great respect for them. But probably the most profound thing is, I don't know how to say this, deeply humbled by them. They did great things. And I could never stand by and let someone demean them or spin their story to destroy the faith. It is a travesty when someone does that. These were great people, and they did great things for the kingdom, and they are examples in every worthy sense of the word. They were human, but they overcame it.
Whether you're LDS or not, you owe these people respect if you live in this state.
Or in the West in general.
Yeah.
Glenn Rossin and Dennis Lyman, thank you so much for being with us.
It's our pleasure.
You've been listening to Why I Believe on the Mormon channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You can get more information about this program and other programs on the Mormon channel by going to mormonchannel.org. Thank you for listening and have a great day.